This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this week's show, a handful of Apple gems.
There's so much great Mac software out there, but there's so many great little programs out there that not a lot of people know about in some cases.
Graham Barlow joins us with some of our favorite budget applications. Also coming up, we look at USB modems.
Being connected to the web wherever I was fantastic, and it meant I could live blog Steve Jobs' Macworld keynote, but it wasn't all plain sailing.
Chris Finn shares his real-world experiences of blogging remotely using Vodafone's USB modem. All that, plus product reviews and Q&A on this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello again, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. We can all name some of the essential applications we have on our Mac, those from Apple, like Apple Mail or iTunes, and then those from third-party companies like, say, Microsoft Office. But there are so many other free or inexpensive apps that can really round out the power and capability of your Macintosh. In the April issue of Mac Format, reporter Holland Jones introduces you to 60 great software products we call Apple Gems. Editor Graham Barlow joins us now to highlight just a few of those Apple gems and explain why they are so special. Graham, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Brad. Nice to be here.
Let me get right into this with you. What is the goal of this feature?
Well, I commissioned this feature because there's so much great Mac software out there, not necessarily from huge developers. A lot of them are freeware, a lot of them are shareware, but there's so many great little programs out there that not a lot of people know about in some cases. Unlike the Windows market, where there's thousands of freeware and shareware applications that are normally pretty bad, most of the Mac ones, because it's a smaller market, the quality tends to be a lot higher. So there's some really great programs, and this feature is just an attempt to highlight some of our favorites.
So the review covers five areas: life-enhancing programs, useful tools and utilities, fun and games, internet applications, and Mac OS X tweaks. We're going to focus on four of these 60, and let's begin with Last.fm Radio Player. It's a website designed to help you discover new music online, right?
Yeah, Last.fm is essentially a website, but they also make a standalone player which you can download. Through Last.fm, you can effectively type in your favorite band, and it creates a radio station of similar artists for you to listen to. So, say you typed in Radiohead, you'd get people like Oasis and Muse, Keen, and everyone on a kind of on a station that you can listen to through your Mac. And the downloaded player is just an easy way of doing it, because you don't have to have your web browser open. You can do it all from the player. I've got it downloaded here on my desktop, so I'll just switch to it now. When you download, you get a nice little interface pop up, and it just asks you one simple question. It says type in an artist, so I could type in Muse, one of my favorites. For example, I click play and off it goes, and it immediately finds various bands that sound very much in the same genre as Muse, and it'll just keep playing them continuously like a, you know, kind of a virtual radio station tailored just to my tastes.
Right, right. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it's great. You'll also discover a lot of music this way, because there'll be a lot of artists you've never heard before that pop up, and you know, if they're playing music that you like anyway, then it's a great way to discover new bands.
Right, now that's Last.fm Radio Player. Let's move on to number two, and that is Visual Hub. And I use Visual Hub, and it's a great product because it allows me to take videos and compress them to play them on my iPod, and it works so well.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites too. It's got what you might say is a very kind of basic looking interface. It's very simple. It's just kind of a gray interface screen. You drag tracks in, you click what format you want them to be in, and you just, you know, hit start, and that's about it. I mean, it's so simple to use. It's the perfect kind of example of great Mac shareware from a smaller developer rather than a huge company. It always seems to work with whatever file format I throw at it. I've made a lot of videos in iMovie from camcorders, and people have recorded stuff in kind of sometimes proprietary formats, like or AVI files with strange codecs on. And whenever I throw them to Visual Hub, I know I can just convert it all into something that my Mac can read, so that I can put them into iMovie without a problem. And as you say, it's great for transferring stuff to the iPod and the iPhone for watching video back.
You were saying it really is compatible with so many different formats that you throw at it, and I think one reason for that, Graham, is the fact that it's constantly updated.
Yeah, there's a very active set of developers on it. I've dropped them a few emails over the time. They're very happy to answer questions if you've got any questions about anything. They're great guys.
All right, our third gem is a game, and it's called Quinn, and the great thing about it is it's basically retro Tetris.
That's right. It's not the most advanced game in the world. It's not a simple one. I quite like the the basic desktop games like Patience and Solitaire and things like that. Quinn really kind of fits into that genre. It's just Tetris under a different name. The great thing is it's completely free, which is quite often the case with a lot of these kind of freeware games for the Mac. You get nice, simple little games, play all the way through. Mm-hmm.
And it's very configurable. You got optional network play as well. Yep. It really has a lot of capabilities that you would find, I think, in a professional game that basically is on the shelf.
Yeah, I mean, it's very well made, which is why I've selected it as one of the kind of standouts in the feature. And it's good to know that, you know, it's not all work for Mac as well. There's lots of fun you can have too.
Right, and there's a lot of other games that are reviewed in this feature by Holland Jones. Simply Solitaire, Tangle, Marble Blast Gold, lots of other fun games to play with. All right, gem number four is Net Newswire, and basically it takes real simple syndication or RSS feeds, but more importantly, this product allows you to manipulate all those RSS feeds incoming to read them easily and better, depending upon what you want to do.
Yeah, Net Newswire is probably my favorite RSS reader of all of them. And until recently, you had to pay for it. Now they've made it free, so it's just ideal. When you log in for the first time, it prompts you to log in to the newsgator.com system. Once you've logged in, it means that whenever you go to the web page and mark a story as read, it will synchronize between various Macs you have that you've got the program installed on. So once you've read a story once, it will always appear as read on all your other Macs as well.
And a nice thing about it is that it integrates with Spotlight and iCal and your address book and iPhoto, so you can email links too.
Absolutely. It's very integrated with all your favorite Mac apps. In fact, it's hard to think of a feature it doesn't have that you'd actually want.
All right, so that's Net Newswire. Lots of other internet applications in the feature as well. Cameo, Garage Sale, Skype, Rapid Weaver to do web designing, and Adium. Lots of great internet applications listed there too. So some great Apple gems, and we've made it really easy to get to them, right?
Yeah, we've got them all in this feature. We've got 60 of them mentioned throughout the feature. But we've managed to put them all on the DVD that goes with the magazine, so you can get straight to them. If you put your DVD in as you read the feature, you can try them out as you're reading. In fact, I think we only got 58 on the DVD in the end because a couple of companies didn't get back to us and give us permission. But 58 out of 60 is not bad.
Yeah, and they're all on the disc, one location, really quickly and easily defined. All right, Graham, thanks so much for going over the Apple gems. They're fantastic and worth taking a look at.
Great, thanks, Brad.
Graham Barlow is editor of Mac Format Magazine. The 12-page feature, 60 Apple Gems, appears on page 26 in the April issue of Mac Format that goes on sale the 5th of March. It's elegant, slim, and ultra-portable. But does the MacBook Air sacrifice hardware punch for portability? Mac Format Reviews editor James Ellerbeck joins us to review the MacBook Air and some great desktop speakers from Creative, the T40 Gigaworks. James joins us in the Mac Format newsroom right now. James, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Hi, Brad.
We'll get to the Creative speakers a little bit later. Let's begin with the MacBook Air. It's an instant design classic, but it's got some issues in terms of exactly what customers is best for this laptop, right?
Yeah, there are a few issues. It's quite a few of the key hardware components have been pared down. There's a lack of processor power. Battery life is pretty weak, and the port allocation is also pretty poor. But despite all these things, it's still perfectly good at what it needs to be, and it's definitely a thing of beauty, and it's the lightest, most compact Mac that we've yet had, so we love it.
James, let's talk about some of the hardware omissions that this MacBook Air has. First of all, it comes in a number of different processor speeds, 1.6 and 1.8, Intel Core 2 Duo, by the way, 13.1-inch glossy display. It weighs 1.3 kilograms. It's a great lightweight design, but again, the hardware omissions really kind of stand out here. Let's talk about some of those. What's missing here?
Well, yeah, people make the comparison with the MacBook Pro because they've both got approximately the same price, but on the MacBook Air you get much slower processor, just a 1.6 gigahertz in a standard model or a 1.8 in the more expensive one. That compares to a 2.5 or 2.6 gigahertz chip in the MacBook Pro at the moment for the same price, so you're nearly a gigahertz of throughput loss there. The hard drive is also a fraction of the size. You get 250 gigabytes in a MacBook Pro these days. You get just 80 gigabytes or 64 with the solid-state drive version of the MacBook Air. You do get 2 gigabytes of RAM in the MacBook Air, which is fine. But yes, you're lacking loads of stuff. Like you've only got one USB port. So if you're using it to connect to, say, an iPod, then you're a little bit stuffed to connect to anything else. Or you don't have an Ethernet port, which rapidly reduces the ability to network the machine.
Right, you don't have a FireWire port, you don't have an audio input jack, you don't have an express card, you don't have Apple Remote, you don't have an optical drive. These things start to really start adding up, and I guess people need to stop and look at this and say, do I need these types of additional features?
Well, if you're living and working in a wireless network, if you've got one at home, a fast one, and you've got a fast one in the office, and you're hopping between Wi-Fi hotspots on your way to work, then you're fine, because the computer does have 802.11n Wi-Fi digital data transfer speed, so it's quite fast. We were streaming video from Apple's site, watching trailers with no problem at all, just using the Wi-Fi connection that we were sitting in. So it's pretty fast for that. You can download most of your medium-sized software updates with no problem at all. And if you do need to pop in some hefty, like multiple gigabyte updates or new software to the machine, then you can always get a USB Ethernet adapter.
James, what else is lacking on the MacBook Air?
Well, the key hardware omission is the lack of an optical drive. There's no super drive, combo drive. You can't play a CD or a DVD or any optical silicon disk inside the MacBook Air. You need to buy an external super drive, which costs £65, and then connect it over USB to the MacBook Air.
Now, your main gripe was battery life, right?
That's right. It was the only thing, really, that got under our skin. We can do without the hardware, because we have other Macs that we use for doing more number-crunching jobs. So we've got desktop machines that we can use for doing all types of rendering and stuff. But for this computer, because you're taking it out on the road, and because you're going to be away, perhaps, from your PowerPoint for a while, you might be on a train, we only got a 2.5-hour average battery life out of it, which is really quite poor. So you can see it.
It's really quite poor when you take into account, James, that Apple is saying that this machine should be getting about 5 hours, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure how they find their figures, but we typically, when we get a new Apple laptop into review, the type of battery life that we see compared to theirs is about 60%. I think they must be running it with the monitor completely dimmed down or nearly asleep, not doing any tasks at all, and having an optimal battery settings inside in the OS. I mean, if you're actually practically using the computer for anything at all, then you're going to experience a battery life of around 2.5 hours. So we're waiting for a battery upgrade. I think we're getting off point. The real value of the MacBook Air is that it's super lightweight. It has enough processing power for the majority of computing that most people do. Very few people push a MacBook Pro to do what it can do. This MacBook Air will give you all the speed that you need for communication, handling photographs, surfing around, downloading things from the web. It also brings you a great look and great convenience when you're walking around, because it weighs next to nothing, and everybody in the office comes around to fawn over it and lift it up, so you get that kind of status symbol that you get through Apple gear.
All right, 3.5 stars for the MacBook Air, James gave it. Despite the lack of hardware features, he said, quote, the MacBook Air is a wonderful Mac that will turn heads everywhere it goes, unquote. So the review on page 82 in the April issue. Let's move on to our second product we're going to review. And these are desktop speakers, very good desktop speakers, actually, from Creative. These are the T40 Gigaworks desktop speakers at £70. You wrote, James, great value for the money and a powerful sound that really brings your Mac alive. Tell us more about these.
Yeah, these are really beefy speakers. They're quite big. They dominate your desktop. But they've got wonderful sound. They've got two main drivers. They've got a bass outlet around the back. They've got a little tweeter in the middle between the two sort of mid-range drivers as well. So pumping out loads of sound. And the sound is really bright without being sort of without washing over you too much or getting too high up inside the range. And just really full of punch. You know, they're a solid bit of kit for your desktop.
Great bass here, right? I mean, real low price for a really tight bass speaker.
Yeah, well, I love that kind of sound. I love that sort of gritty reggae sound or soul sound. And these can just pump that out gloriously. And they go really loud without distorting, which is fine. You can have the volume quite low, but it still engages you. And you're only paying 70 quid for them as well, which seems like a bargain considering there's loads of manufacturers who are popping out speakers which do, well, probably as good a job or slightly less good a job, but they're charging twice that.
Yeah, especially when you say here that they have really good quality and strong parts. I mean, they've improved the buttons and the casing and the knobs and everything else.
Yeah, they feel really solid. I mean, they're reassuringly heavy to pick up, but when you turn the knobs, it's got nothing wobbles, you know, it's all very finely crafted. So that makes them a pleasure to use.
Now, one other criticism you had, and it might not be that big of a one, is that you thought these speakers were really big compared to, say, the Harman Kardon sound sticks.
They are. Well, they're considerably more expensive, the sound sticks, and they are fantastic as well. In fact, I kind of prefer the sound sticks because they're smaller, but they produce a sound 10 times bigger than their size. These ones, they don't have that level of engineering because they are very chunky, very big. I mean, they sit taller than my MacBook Pro, so they're more, I think, for a desktop Mac, like an iMac, rather than for a MacBook.
All right, so 4 out of 5 stars for the Creative T4 GigaWorks desktop speakers. You wrote, solid offering that gives back a lot of quality for this amount of money, turns a Mac into a rounded media center. So those are great speakers, given a Best Value Award by MacFormat and James Ellerbeck, and that's the T40 GigaWorks. That review, by the way, is on page 85. James, thanks so much for joining us and going over these speakers and the MacBook Air.
You're welcome, Brad.
James Ellerbeck is reviews editor for MacFormat magazine. His reviews begin on page 81 in the April issue of MacFormat magazine. So you're on the road with your Mac laptop, and you're accessing the internet either wirelessly using Wi-Fi or hardwiring into a hotel network, for instance. What if you're in the middle of nowhere and all you've got is a mobile phone? Well, the obvious solution is to dial into the internet using a USB modem. Now, few of us use USB modems because of the cost and the slow speeds, but is the experience really all that bad? The always resourceful deputy editor Chris Finn used his trip to San Francisco for last January's Macworld Expo to test out Vodafone's USB modem, and he joins us now to tell us whether you should consider a USB modem service as well. Chris, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Brad.
You used the USB modem to do live blogging for the Steve Jobs keynote address on the MacFormat website back in January. Explain what you did and your overall experience.
Okay, so we got this modem from Vodafone because we wanted to live blog Steve Jobs' keynote. And there's never any Wi-Fi. They always either turn it off or they block it. And the only way to get connected is via the mobile phone network. And in years gone by, when I've been covering the keynote, I've used a link to my mobile phone. But this is just a little bit neater. It plugs straight into USB. You're less dependent on Bluetooth or anything like that. And it should, in theory, have less of an impact on your battery life as a result. So we've got this modem and set it up in the UK, as you'd expect, and it was fine, it was great. Took it to the States, connected it up there as well, and it was fine, automatically hooked onto Vodafone's partner carrier in the States, AT&T, and it worked fine. However, come the morning of the keynote, or rather the night before the keynote, it was giving me problems. It was having problems getting connected and finding the network. I was tearing my hair out with it. I finally got it working okay, and on the day of the keynote itself, I did manage to do a live blog. It wasn't great because everyone there was using iPhones. iPhones, by and large, are connected to the AT&T network in the States. So the whole network, I think, was really, really straining under the strain of all having the iPhones connected to it. So I was getting very, very slow download and upload speeds in the single figures for kilobytes per second. It was possible, though, and it was certainly much, much more convenient and much less of a headache than trying to do something else.
Now, email and doing blogging, that doesn't take up a lot of bandwidth, but web pages, different story. What was it like using the USB modem in terms of just bringing up, say, for instance, CNN.com or BBC.co.uk?
In the UK, it was fine. We were getting broadband speeds. We were downloading stuff, uploading stuff, sending emails, receiving emails. Not a problem. In the States, it was a little bit different. I was only getting connected to GPRS. Whether that was because of the way the network was set up or because of the way the device was configured, I could not work out. And it was okay. You know, it could be done. But it wasn't particularly pleasant. It was fine for email, but it wasn't all that smashing for browsing the web.
Right, so it's really important for people to remember here, it was in the United States where you had most of the problems. Here in the UK, it was pretty good.
Yeah, that's an important point to make. I mean, in the UK, we get pretty good speeds. the coverage for 3G broadband is pretty good. I mean, if you look at the map we have in the magazine or the map that's on Vodafone's website, you'll see that 3G broadband is pretty widespread, particularly in the sort of urban areas where the population's at its most dense. So it's not bad. And if you're in central London, you're laughing. Central London and Isle of Dogs, where the financial districts are, you get, or you're promised, at least a theoretical maximum of 7.2 megabit per second. And that's rivaling what most people will get on their home broadband. In fact, the UK average is somewhere around 2 megabit per second download speeds. So as long as you're connected with a modem like the one I had in central London, you're laughing. It's cracking speed.
So in terms of pricing plans in the UK, and I know there are quite a few and they're listed in your article, give us an idea of what people can expect in terms of pricing.
Okay, so yeah, there are a bunch of different ways of doing it. The easiest way to do it, if you're a very light user, is you can buy it without a contract. So you pay £100 for the modem hardware itself, and then thereafter you're charged £8.50 a month for every 24 hours. If you want to use your modem, it'll cost you £8.50 a month if you're on a sort of pay-as-you-talk model. Obviously, you can also buy a contract, and you can buy currently with Vodafone a 12, 18 or 24 month contract, and within those are a bunch of different data plans, and within each individual plan you've got mobile broadband and mobile broadband travel. The difference is that with mobile broadband, which is usually £25 a month, it will cost you quite a bit to use your mobile modem abroad. If you're on one of the travel plans, then you get £200 megabytes of data every month included in your plan on foreign networks. Remember as well that these are subject to fair use policies. So in the UK, you're subject to about a 500 megabyte fair use policy. And if you are roaming, if you're abroad, it's 50 megabyte. 500 megabytes is usually fine. I can't imagine most people would trip that. But 50 meg when you're abroad, you're talking a few hefty email attachments and a bit of browsing. And if you dare to stream any media from the BBC's Listen Again archive, for example, you could quickly trip that. So be careful of it if you're abroad.
Now, there are issues of compatibility with Leopard in using these USB modems. Explain the current problem.
When I was using this modem, in fact, I hadn't been aware that the drivers that were on the website were for 10.4 only, not 10.4 or later, so they weren't particularly designed to work with Leopard. When I was using it, it was fine in the UK. When I started to use it in the US and started to try and play about with and troubleshoot some of the issues I was having, the problems became particularly obvious. The drivers weren't Leopard friendly. I was getting errors saying an application of class key not found exception was not handled, the application must shut down. So the sort of utility app that accompanied the modem hardware itself was launching and then immediately throwing up that error as soon as it tried to find a network, and then just crapping out, so I couldn't actually use it to be able to configure stuff, and I was swapping SIM cards in and out. Luckily, the good news is that now Vodafone has updated their drivers, so if you buy it now, or indeed if you're a Leopard user who has this, you can download the updated drivers on Vodafone's site, so that problem has been solved, and I only wish it had been solved when I was in America, because my hairline, which is receding enough as it is, suddenly leapt back an inch or two when I was trying to sort the problems out that I was having.
Okay, so bottom line here, it wasn't plain sailing all the way through for your experience with the USB modem, but is using a USB modem a good alternative to Wi-Fi? And if so, who is it good for?
Bear in mind that there are different strokes for different folks. They do different things. Wi-Fi is a location-based service. If you are somewhere where there's a Wi-Fi hotspot, you're fine. If you're not, you're screwed. And that's the problem. It's that sort of second subset of people who need to be connected wherever they are. And let's face it, you don't need 3G broadband necessarily to be able to get connected. For most people, connectivity is more about email and web surfing than it is about hardcore data downloading. So wherever you are in the country, you're pretty much guaranteed to get a mobile phone signal of some kind or another, and it will step down. So if you can only get 3G broadband, you'll get 3G broadband, or you'll get 3G, or you'll get GPRS. So, you know, it will step down. You'll get slower speeds. So it's designed for those sort of people, particularly sort of business folk who are traveling around who want to have a connection to the internet wherever they are. Bottom line, if you want to be connected wherever you are, you need something that will connect to the cellular data network.
Now, Chris, I want to ask you, you have an iPhone, which I don't have an iPhone. I've been fighting the urge, unlike you. But versus the iPhone, which is not 3G right now, and the Vodafone USB modem service, which is 3G, would you say right now that this is a really good alternative until we go 3G on the iPhone for people?
the iPhone's much more convenient. Obviously, with the iPhone, you can just pull it out of your pocket and tap away, and it's all good. With the setup that I had, I was occasionally having to pull my entire laptop out of my satchel, connect up the USB modem, and connect that way just to check something like the address of a restaurant that I was having lunch at, which was a bit of a pain. But bear in mind that with the iPhone, with its connection to the Edge network, that's fine if all you're doing is letting email trickle into your inbox. But it is frustrating for browsing. The 3G modem is much, much faster, but you've got to balance out that with the convenience of a pocket-sized device like the iPhone.
All right, Chris, thanks for going over your review of the Vodafone USB modem, giving people an idea what other alternatives are out there.
My pleasure, Brad.
Chris Finn is deputy editor of MacFormat magazine. His 5-page feature, On the Road with Vodafone's USB Modem, appears on page 20 in the April issue that goes on sale on the 5th of March. Trevor Middleton joins us again for questions and answers from our readers. Welcome back, Trevor.
Thank you very much, Brad. How are you?
Very good. We're ready to get right into 3 great questions. On each episode, Trevor will do his best to answer your questions. You can email him at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And please remember to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Let's get right into it. First question is from Ben Ward in Lincoln. And he writes, I've got a quick query that may be a simple one to fix. All my music is stored on a shared folder on my G5 iMac, which I then use Front Row on the MacBook to access my shared media. So far, so good, except that when I launch Front Row, my music shows up in a shared library, but the album artwork often doesn't, even though it's okay in iTunes. Is there a simple fix, or will it require something a bit more complex?
Okay, well, Ben, like you, I have a shared iTunes music library on my iMac, which I access via my network. And what I've found is that sometimes a slight variation in the information about a track means that its artwork isn't displayed properly, mainly because iTunes thinks that that particular track isn't part of the album that it should belong to. Sometimes, then, if you select all the tracks in an album and add the artwork manually, that'll sort out the problem. Alternatively, try deleting the plist file for iTunes, which is in the Preferences folder on your Mac, and that will make iTunes behave as though it's being launched for the first time, and it will therefore create a new database. There seems to be no quick, definitive solution to this one, but I've found both of those helpful. Give us a try, and let us know if they work. Brad.
All right, question 2 comes to us from Neil Cunningham in Hillsborough, Northern Ireland, and he writes us, my son bought a card reader that attaches to my MacBook via a USB 2.0 lead. It is supposed to be Mac compatible, but there's a driver on the mini CD which will not fit the slot on my MacBook. We've all heard this before, those little mini CDs that come with lots of software. Consequently, when the card reader is attached, nothing shows up on the desktop. Can you suggest how I can get the card reader to work?
Okay, well, for most USB devices such as card readers, flash drives, and external hard disks, you shouldn't need a driver, as they're supported by a class of generic drivers called USB mass storage. If you try inserting a card into the device, it should mount on the desktop of your MacBook as though it were another disk. If it doesn't, it might be an issue with the amount of power that the USB port is supplying. The reason you received a CD with your card reader is that not all earlier operating systems support USB mass storage. Windows 98, for example. If you have an old Mac lying about, there's a downloadable driver for macOS 8.6, though full support for USB mass storage was incorporated into macOS from OS 9 onwards, so you should be okay with that, Neil. Just try popping a card into the card reader.
And question 3 is from Mike Moody in Reading, Berkshire. He wrote, I have a PowerMac G5 2 GHz dual processor with 4 GB of memory and an NVIDIA GeForce 6600 LE graphics card running macOS 10.4.11. I use Aperture version 1.5 to manage my photos, but find some of the tools unusable as they are just too slow and unresponsive. The tools are Straighten and Spot and Patch. I was wondering if my graphics card is just not up to the job. Trevor.
Well, Mike, your PowerMac certainly meets the minimum system requirements for Aperture. For a PowerMac G5 tower, Apple says that you should have a minimum 1.6 GHz processor and 2 GB of memory. However, I've been ringing around this morning, and to judge from a few conversations I've had with professional photographers and image editors, Aperture does make pretty heavy demands on the graphics processing unit on your graphics card and also the graphics memory. So yes, I would think about a new graphics card. The one in your tower has 128 megabytes of graphics memory. The Radeon X1900 is available in a PowerMac G5 edition. That has 256 megabytes of dedicated graphics memory. So think about it. It's a little expensive, it's a little pricey, but worth thinking about as your G5 tower is obviously up to the job in most other ways. So also, if you want a quick, cheap solution, I've heard of users turning off dashboard to save system resources. And if you want to do that, you can either go into the command line in terminal, or if you like to do things the easy way, and most of us do, you can use a utility such as Tinkertool to turn off dashboard and save those precious system resources. Brad.
All right, Trevor, thanks so much for answering our three questions this time around.
No problem at all. See you next time.
All right, you can email us at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk, and please remember to tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Graham Barlow, Chris Finn, James Ellerbeck, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Cycloropolo. We'll be back with another edition on Monday, the 17th of March. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.